Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the fifth in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas, and I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. I want to introduce the panel now. We have Rick Maestrom, Suzanne McCausland, and Charles Hayes. Suzanne is a newbie. This is her first time here. And Rick and Charles are seasoned veterans. Today's discussion is going to be about two economic systems that have been around this world for many decades now, some might say centuries, and that is socialism and capitalism. For starters, we need to make sure that we are not talking about different things that we may think have the same name. So please, each one of you, start with Rick. Give us your own definition and examples, if you can, of both capitalism and socialism.
Okay. My definition of socialism would be a system in which the government controls the means of production. When it was first defined, those means of production meant factories, etc. Now means of production may very well mean finances. But socialism is when the government contains or controls the means of production. Capitalism is when individuals make their own decisions for the purpose of making a profit, and following the leadership of Adam Smith, that creates an invisible hand that gives each people an ability to produce what's needed most in their country.
Charles, what do you think about capitalism and socialism?
I agree with pretty much everything Rick said. But the invisible hand becomes a pickpocket at certain stages. And to me, an ism, by nature of being an ism, is incomplete in itself. Capitalism is extremely strong. So is socialism. Both of their strengths are also their weaknesses. So, not enough of either one is not enough to do the job. Too much is oppressive.
Suzanne, what is your view on those two systems?
Well, I see it a little bit differently because I see the basic needs of people usually are met by a socialistic viewpoint. And right now we're looking at health care. And, of course, that's going to be under attack for a while. But also the infrastructure of how do you deal with major fires like California's going through and flooding? And how do you allocate lands that should be used for agriculture? Or how do you make the decisions where pipelines are going to go and for the greater good of the people? And I see socialism more in that standpoint and also a basic need of the infrastructure than a political idea.
Should we be allowed to connect socialism with communism as we know as Stalin's Soviet Union, Mao's China, or the current regimes as Putin's oligarchical Russia? And the high-powered manufacturing giant that China has become today, should we be connecting socialism as we know it today, or as we have just defined it, with those particular systems, Russia and China back in the day?
I think not. I think people do associate, when you say, what's an example of a socialist country? They'll say, well, Soviet Union is. But that's not necessarily the case. In fact, when Karl Marx first wrote his manifesto, he said there's a specter haunting Europe, and that's the specter of communism. So he was worried that communism would negatively affect his philosophy of socialism. So they shouldn't automatically be associated with each other.
Well, I think it was a utopian idea that communism would work. And it all depended on who finally took over power. And that's what corrupted it. But to me, a socialistic government is one that provides certain basic needs for the population. Even if it's public education or it's a basic way of evacuating people in a disaster, or it's schools. Of course, schools I've already mentioned, but health care. These are basic things that we've discussed for a long time. The problem that I see in the definitions that we tend to lock things into a certain box is that, say you belong to a union, and that provides you with some sort of a baseline in case disaster strikes. So you will get some unemployment. You'll get some health care. You'll get someone looking out for the safety of you and where you're working. And certainly we had this issue here in Alaska.
So are you saying that the union is what gives you that baseline protection? I thought it was the government that with unemployment benefits.
I think the union actually is probably they're striving for the minimum wage to be a living wage. And they have benefits that they offer their people that we are always fighting over whether we're going to have health care for everyone, whether we're going to have a minimum wage and what that should be. And so we're always being challenged. So socialism is an attempt to work out the fight, the argument, and saying, what is our social responsibility? And that's the way I see it.
Okay. Charles, was there a connection there between Stalin's Russia and socialism today?
I don't think so. I think I agree with what Rick said. But my particular view is that we need a good mix of socialism and capitalism. I mean, capitalism is wonderful for the competitive spirit, and socialism is good for a safety net. The economy for working people only works well if companies have to compete for employees. That's the only time wages ever are, you know, I grew up at a time when we had living wages. When in the 1950s, a person could go to work without any experience at a gas station and make enough to buy a home and a car, and your wife didn't even have to work. And look where we are now.
When the Cold War ended in the 1990s, was that a time when we looked at capitalism as defeating socialism?
Well, I think all of the 20th century was a fight between democracy and communism, democracy and autocracy. So it was more a fight between the political systems, because that's the political systems. That's the first part of the 20th century. There weren't a lot of big democracies.
But weren't the economic systems tied with them, those political?
In a lot of ways, they were. The communist systems in those cases were generally socialistic. They control the means of production. There's other places where just pure dictatorships are socialistic. And when you look at the history of those, there was a way to sort of divide up things first by dictatorships and build things and control and stabilize economies. And you can look way back at the Egypt during the time the pyramids were built. They built those pyramids because there was a dictator who controlled all of the production. But that doesn't mean that the people were well off. I mean, those pyramids were built at a huge cost of human life, just as, and so you can call that socialism, but it's more dictatorial socialism. And the same thing for the Great Wall of China, built at a huge cost of human life. So those people who thought they were very productive really are unaware of what the problem was there. It was just a huge human life con, and we don't have that anymore. We're much better off under our what I call a mix, and I kind of agree with what you're saying, or a mix of socialism and capitalism. And now we were taught, and I was taught in economics 50 years ago in college, and I'm going to my 50th reunion this month, University of Colorado, and we were taught that America is a mixed system. It's not a capitalist system. It's a mixed system, and government plays a role in it, and kind of as John Maynard Keynes said in his Keynesian economics. So I think we're a mixed system, something like, Suzanne was saying.
Well, after the end of World War II, we made an enormous investment in this country in hard and soft infrastructure, rural development, interstate highway system, GI Bill, all sorts of programs. And it actually created the middle class. In about beginning in the early 1970s, we've been chipping away at that until we're losing it. Now, the top 1% owns 90% of the wealth. 38% of the people in this country make less than $20,000 a year, and $28,000 is the poverty level. So we're going in the wrong direction, especially with regard to digital technology. I mean, algorithms are eating jobs left and right, and it somehow we have to find a balance for that.
One of the books I brought in is called We Shall Be Remembered, and it was the birthplace of Palmer. And it was an experiment by FDR. And it was a socialistic experiment. And one of the interesting things, Evangeline Atwood is the author of this. And she was married to, she was born in Alaska. She was married to the magnate of the state newspapers. And the interesting thing about that was that it got received extreme amount of criticism because it was called communism or it was called socialism. To me, they're two different things. And so that people riding on the trains, the reporters, were lambasting everyone.
Just because of the name?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. I don't think it was the name. It was really about who is going to control the resources. Alaska, they didn't want to have colonized. Because then they would have to pay taxes. They'd have to support an infrastructure. So we had all the Guggenheims and the big money people out fighting this, and they put the reporters on the trains to denigrate it. But the reality is, and there's still people lambasting the whole project. To me, it was a success because we had people come and settle. And because of that, we were able to move into statehood.
Okay, you just segued me into the next question, which is two of the most famous socialist initiatives in American history are Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s, out of which came Social Security, and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, the 1960s, which produced Medicare for us. Did the implementation of those programs, which required massive government spending both times, benefit or hurt the social order in the long term in America? Were they benefits, or did they hurt us?
They were benefits.
I'd hate to see where we'd be without Social Security.
And where would Alaska be? We would probably still be, we're still at the mercy of the extractors, but we at least have a stable population that we wouldn't have had.
Well, I think they were benefits. Your mention of Social Security, I'd say that if Congress was subjected to the same laws that industry was subjected to or is subjected to, they would be in jail for spending that trust money in Social Security because there is no money in Social Security. We pay for it. We've been putting in for 70 years now, 80 years, and it's gone. So we have Congress spent it. And if one of the big banks that went under had done that, their leaders would all be in jail. So there are things the government does wrong. But I think that in generally looking at the question, I think we are better off because of those. And also Eisenhower's building of the interstate highway system. That's government spending. So that's part of the mixed economy that we are.
All roads are basically government initiated.
They are, as a matter of fact. And some local, some state, and some nationally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think it's important to have just a pure capitalist economy. And I was trying to think on the way over here, what would I say is purely a capitalistic economy? And the only two countries I could think of that were really close to that were Singapore and Hong Kong. Hong Kong before the takeover by China and Singapore. Because they don't have much big, broad infrastructure to take care of, but it's government that has to take care of that infrastructure. But it takes money from the private sector to do that.
One of Ronald Reagan's famous campaign quotes when he ran for president was, and I'm paraphrasing here, so if I get this wrong, you can correct me. Government isn't the solution to the problems. Government is the problem. And this attitude has been the foundation for the conservative movement, with the exception of, you know, the personal uterus of the individual American woman, where government is an active stakeholder for more than 40 years now. Is Reagan correct? partly correct, wrong, partly wrong. Is government always the problem? Can government ever be the solution?
He said that and then grew the government.
Well, he was senile when he became president.
Well, I don't agree he was senile when he became president, but he certainly did have the onset of Alzheimer's during his presidency.
He lived down the street from me.
We're talking about what he said, not what his medical condition was.
Well, though, that's a serious
one. Government was the problem. Government is the problem.
Yeah, well, he was always a spokesperson for all sorts of different industries. I don't think he was any different in that position.
Well, government can be the problem, no doubt, if it's not held to account. And we keep fixing the system where we can't hold it to account or people don't pay enough attention to hold it to account. But government is absolutely very necessary. We have a situation right now, if you compare it to the National Football League, it's like right now only the number one team owns the referees. And, you know, so...
I don't know where that came from.
I don't either.
I don't think I agree with that.
No.
I think maybe the number one home team. Go ahead, Rick.
Gosh, I lost my train of thought when you said
the number one team owns the officials.
Yeah, me too.
I forgot what I was
saying. Well, it was about Reagan making the comment about the government being the problem.
You know, I think he's partly correct. Mm-hmm. There's oftentimes I've referred to the gross inefficiency of national government. And when you get a huge organization like this where people are basically spending other people's money, it's not as efficient as the private sector. It plays a role. But it's not as efficient as the private sector. And I've had so many people say, well, I'm voting for a Democrat in local elections for mayor, because we always get more money from them when they're going to buy some property from us or when they want to take over things or use eminent domain. We always make a lot more money because they tend to be more framed within the government doing more things. And you're not as efficient. And I've been both in the private sector and government sector, and nobody is as conscientious about spending other people's money as they are about spending their own money. So that's a concern. When you go too far one way, and that is government gets too big, then you have a lot of inefficiencies both in production and spending of money.
Well, let me restate my NFL thing. It's as if the government, I mean, as if the NFL, as if the major team owned all the referees, because if you're not connected to special interests in this country, you don't get to hold the government to account. Our paid for representatives do that very well.
So you're basically saying it's the special interests who are funding the campaigns that are calling the shots.
Absolutely,
right. Exactly. You've said it.
Yeah, and the special interests can be unions as much as mm-hmm. businesses.
Sure, except no for the it. Unions are getting the air kicked out of them left and right. I remember my father was part of the union here in Alaska, and he'd be called a communist. You know, they started labeling them. That was, of course, during the Eisenhower administration. And it was really nasty.
We're talking the McCarthy era now, whenever that was.
Well, McCarthy was definitely the force, the evil force. He was having great fun, but that was also when Eisenhower was president. And so I think that the real balance here is that if we allow capitalism to call the shots, they're only interested in money and what they can make. And many times they don't care too much about the future because they can always find something else to exploit. And what's being exploited are usually the workers, or it's the minerals that they're extracting and not paying for.
And consumers. Consumers can be exploited as well as workers.
Yeah.
All right, I want to get back to something that Charles said a little bit ago about basically income inequality. Since the 1980s, there has been a tremendous shift in who possesses the wealth in America. According to a report by Nick Hanover, published recently in Politico, in 1980, the bottom 50% of Americans owned 18%, and the top 1% had 8% of the wealth in America. Today, 2017, the bottom half has 11%, while the top 1% now has 22%. So you can see that shift. If this trend continues in 40 years, the bottom half will own 6% of American wealth, and the top 1% will own 40% of the American wealth. Is this healthy?
No.
In his book, Capital, Thomas Piketty said, accumulated wealth grows faster than output and wages, and the resultant inequality expresses a logical contradiction. The entrepreneur inevitably tends to become more and more dominant over those who own nothing but their labor. Once constituted, capital reproduces itself faster than output increases. The past devours the future. He argues that the long-term dynamics of our growing inequality are terrifying, especially when one adds that the return on capital varies directly with the size and initial stake, and that the divergence in the wealth distribution is occurring on a global scale.
I don't know what you just said. I don't know if the words were just a little bit too big for me to understand. Can you synthesize what that statement, what do you mean by that?
He's saying that exponentially, over a long period of time, and I think he did something almost like 300 years worth of history, exponentially, capital grows faster than productivity and wages, and it gets way out of whack. To me, that's what has to be addressed. I mean, we need to keep the competition aspect of capitalism, but we need to mitigate the creative destruction.
Well, I think, when we talk about the fact that the 1% of the population has gotten out 22% of the value of America, I think maybe what we need to do is tell all those smart guys in Silicon Valley not to work so hard. Tell Sergey Brin he ought to get out of Google. Quit exploiting that. And how about Apple? How about Steve Jobs? How about Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg? And how about those guys that have created so much? And Bill Gates, the creator of Microsoft, they've done so much to add productivity, but they're part of that body. It used to be the Sam Waltons of the world that did it. Now it's
yeah,
those
Warren
guys
Buffett's.
Have created so much value. And Warren Buffett, they've created so much value.
Yes, and they didn't do it by themselves either.
No,
the whole
they didn't.
Country helped them do it.
And they made a lot of people multimillionaires.
Yes. And the technology and what they have done is wonderful. It's dividing up as some kind of a reasonable value is the big problem. I mean, we have a current situation where public corporations are openly looted. I mean, we have people making $10,000 an hour crying crocodile tears about people going to make $10 an hour.
That's right. And so if you are that wealthy and your wealth is going to grow no matter what you do, and we have a percentage of those people, and they have no social conscience. They are not looking back and saying, what is good for all? They're ignoring that. And when that happens, we have a serious problem. And I think actually that's the state we're in.
We have lost the ability to have people who have the capacity to pay a fair share of taxes to get them to do it. We no longer have the power to do that.
Bill Gates now has a foundation that's worth over $2 billion, and he's giving more and more of that away. It's now way up beyond that, I think. Mark Zuckerberg just announced that he's going to give 80% of his value wealth to charity. And to say that these people don't care about anybody else, I think is dead
and
wrong.
Bill Gates advocates taxes being much higher.
As a capitalist myself, and I know all my life people have loved working for companies that I've owned, and they talk about it. They still talk about it. We had a reunion out of my house in the lake in the valley, and 100 former employees came up and just talked about how much they enjoyed it. And so it's not just being a capitalist that makes you evil.
So you're disputing the fact of all business people being lumped into this.
I am. There's a lot of really decent wonderful business people that are helping make Anchorage. And when I was mayor of Anchorage, I called on business all the time to help make our city better. And they were there. They helped out.
I think you misquoted me. I'm going to correct you. What I'm saying is that there is a social responsibility. When you're earning that much wealth, there are many people that just from the interest, they don't have to work and it'll still just keep growing. I'm saying that that is an unbalanced distribution of the wealth. And what are they contributing really for the long-term economy? What are they giving back? Because shouldn't that be part of the way we look at our lives?
Then I think Rick was pointing out that Bill Gates has given a lot back.
Yes, he has.
With his foundation.
Yes, and he advocates taxes being much higher than they are.
Right. Taxation is a huge part of it because it's an equal way of distributing things that are needed in the infrastructure. And that's what we're really talking about here is we're not keeping up with the needs of our people. We're not giving adequate health care. We're not having a minimum wage. We don't have any cushion for those that fall through the security net. And so what are these people that are earning all this money and they're giving it away to what? To charities and things when they could be putting it back into the tax base where it could be distributed to help everybody.
In the 1950s, corporations paid about 30% of the taxes. Now it's barely 10%.
In the 1950s, the highest tax rate was 90%.
I know.
Well, you know, it is interesting because really, what do we want? What is the goal of our society? It's to educate our kids, our grandkids, and to prepare them for the future and to make them be productive. And we also want to make sure that we sustain our infrastructures, and we want to be able to be self-sustaining in what we grow, and we eat healthy vegetables and food. And those are the sort of things that are kind of basic needs. And then we fund the war machine, and we haven't even talked about that.
Today we haven't. We have not talked about the American funding of the war machine. Rick, you want to, before we leave that topic, have one more thing to say about that?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Let's look at one country that has never been under the Soviet orbit but has included a good bit of socialism in its culture and society, and that nation is Norway. Norway has a market economy, universal health care, social security, and a number of large state-owned industries, including petroleum, natural gas production, hydroelectric energy production, aluminum, telecommunication, and banking. The state owns 30% of the stock value on the Oslo Stock Exchange. Outside the Middle East, Norway is the world's largest oil producer. It has the fourth highest per capita income, ranks number one in the World Happiness Report. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has it ranked number one on the Better Life Index. The Index of Public Integrity and Democracy also has Norway ranked number one. Do you think we ought to be taking a closer look at Norway and how it has merged capitalist and socialist principles?
You know, the difference in us and them? We just say that we're the greatest all the time, and we repeat it ad nauseum.
And they actually rank number one. Yeah. They don't even have to brag about it.
There's 10 countries that has quality of life much better than ours. But we just keep saying we're great. We're great.
Well, some of us feel we're great, and we don't necessarily say it. I'm not one that says America first. I don't agree with that. I'm more of an internationalist than Donald Trump is. But when you look at Norway is a good example of a mixed economy. It's capitalistic plus it's socialistic. It's more to the left. If we say the far left is pure socialism, to the far right is pure capitalism, they're more to the left than we are. But Alaska is probably the most socialistic of all the states because we have in Alaska, if you looked at the total assets, the total private assets of in Alaska, the government owns almost as much as the private sector. We're almost 50% owned by government. And when you add in the
value of the permanent... You're talking about land now?
No, land and finances. You know, the $71 billion the state has in the bank. So you look at the $70 billion, $1 billion, all of the state buildings, the state land, et cetera. Well, it's very close to what the private sector is. It's about 50-50 when you look at that. And we also have a situation where... when we do capital projects, it really is a boost to the economy because every other state has to first take money out of the economy, out of the private sector, to raise money to do capital projects where we already have the money sitting in accounts that's already been taxed. I mean, we've been taxed that money, and it's sitting in accounts, so we can spend it on
capital
projects.
Have we been taxed, or is it the oil companies that have been taxed?
Well, newspapers nationally debate that. At the same time, U.S. News and World Report, back when it was in existence, called Alaska the most undertaxed state in America. USA Today called it the most overtaxed state in America because they included oil taxes. U.S. World News and World Report did not. So we are overtaxed if we look at the taxes on oil companies and the oil products that we have. So it's tough to say.
I don't pay any state taxes.
No.
All my taxes are to the Matt Nuska borough.
And yet with all this wealth, we are cutting our classes. We're taking all our benefits away from our teachers. We're putting them on. We may hire you next year status. My daughter worked as a teacher. It's a lot of hard work.
And we also have a $3 billion annual budget deficit with our state government.
That's right.
As well.
So where is all this money?
Well, I hear people talk about how poor the school districts are, the school budgets are. So I had somebody tell me about a month ago, a friend of mine tell me, a smart lady in my Rotary Club say, boy, teachers are just leaving to go to higher paid jobs. So I started researching it. And online in the best jobs in America, they had public teaching jobs, and they had the highest public teaching jobs in Nassau County, New York. The second highest was Anchorage, Alaska. The third highest was Fairbanks, Alaska, the highest paid teaching jobs. So we're paying our teachers a lot. I mean, they're starting at $48,000 a year, and that doesn't include the wonderful benefits they get, the retirement, the time off. When I started on the assembly in Anchorage, the school district budget and the state and the city budget were both $120 million. In that period of time, since 1980, the city budget's gone up to $420 million. The school district budget's gone up to $880
million. And there's more students. However, what you're quoting are the prices for someone that has tenure. The teacher that is hired on and constantly has to come back and be hired on again is not earning those sort of wages, and they're not getting those sort of benefits.
Or have the job security.
They don't have the job security. Right. And their classrooms are overfilled. They have to take the work home that they can't finish at school, so their hours are not 9 to 5 or 8 to 5. They go way into the evening and in the weekends.
So part of Rick's calculation has to include the increase in population.
I'm quoting the Anchorage School District.
It's the same population
increase in Anchorage and same population increase in the schools. So all I'm saying is that school districts, there is a lot of money there. It just needs to be spent carefully. And you talk to contractors and they'll say, man, if we get a school contract, we're set for life. I'm going to retire on that one because it's people spending other people's money. And there's so much waste. And they don't say that publicly because they want to keep getting the contracts.
I think you're misrepresenting.
There's a lot of waste in the school districts.
We have schools that need roofs repaired. We have an ever-increasing number of kids arriving. And these kids are in need. My daughter teaching was taking food to the schools so they'd have something to eat in the morning. A lot of these are slope workers, and they don't come home and take care of the kids.
You keep pounding on the table.
I'm sorry. But that is the real concern, is that what are the needs? I mean, you're quoting numbers, but I don't think they're realistic, and I don't think that's the way it is at all, because I've had personal experience.
Charles, go ahead. You're about ready to break something
I would say that we could learn a whole lot from Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, Iceland, a whole lot of different countries. Now, I spent 40 years in the Alaska oil industry, and let me tell you, if Alaska owned Prudhoe Bay, if we owned that oil, we wouldn't be talking about petty stuff about schools right now. We'd be sitting on $500 billion at least.
Norway has a hydroelectric system which produces its electricity, and all its oil that it produces goes into the state coffers. And so their taxes are still pretty high, where we have no taxes, no state taxes as far as our income or our state sales tax, and they seem to be in a lot better shape financially, even though, as Rick mentioned, we have a huge amount of money that we put in our coffers from the high oil taxes in the day whenever we were producing a lot of oil.
You know, if we were to count, and often people say, boy, look how much money Norway has, and it's, they don't call it the permanent fund, but their heritage fund or whatever they call it there. But our money goes, number one, goes to the federal government too, as well as the state government. So if you want to look at all the money we'd have, they just have the federal government. When you say state, you really meant federal government, the state of Norway or the federal government of Norway.
Federal government of Norway, I meant Norway. The state taxes of Alaska, state of Alaska, yes.
But when you're talking about Norway, that's all the money from the oil companies goes to its national government. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about us, a lot goes to the national government. Some goes to the state government. I don't know what that percentage is. And then we've saved a lot. For those who think we've pissed it away, I don't think we have. We've got $70 billion now in reserves that we haven't spent. And so there is money there.
Way back in the middle of the 19th century, Abraham Lincoln was bedeviled and concerned that wages were going to be subordinate to capital, and that people were going to become wage slaves. And we champion freedom in this country all the time. Freedom, freedom, freedom. We talk about it all the time. But people who are working on the minimum wage are not really free if choices have anything to do with that freedom. And these people in Norway and these other countries have more freedom. They can quit their job and go somewhere else if they don't like it. They don't have to lose their health insurance. I mean, we need a better mix of socialism and capitalism than we've got right now.
Well, it's really hard if your wages don't pay your rent or have it's enough to buy food. And that seems to be an increasing issue in America today.
Well, the big thing, too, is, I mean, technology is fabulous. It's terrific. I mean, the future, I mean, can be incredible, but we have to learn how to distribute the value a little bit better than it's not going to work. And we're going to have people walking in, taken to the streets in protest.
A big development that has occurred with technology is that instead of having people working in the factories, we have robots doing all the work in the factories. And there just seems to be no other way that we figured out for those jobs to be developed that were lost in the factory.
Well, white-collar workers are facing the same thing that happened in manufacturing. I mean, physicians can't diagnose as well as a supercomputer. I mean— And it's moving in that direction. In the future, people are going to be subordinate to an app. And when you're subordinate to an app, unless you've got some kind of a union, you're not going to have enough equity. You're not going to have reasonable wages.
It sounds to me like we're repeating the issues in the 1960s and 70s when the auto industry started automating production and the union said, oh, that's terrible. We can't do that because look at the jobs we're losing, you know, and they fought against it. They fought against it. And in fact, it made over the last 50 years, it's made our auto industry competitive with the rest of the
world.
Look, we're making great cars.
And we've got the worst inequality right now since the 1920s.
And there's Detroit. There's Detroit. It's dead. I mean,
yeah, well, Detroit's dead, but all the other cities that are not taxed
there's
a lot of manufacturing.
Big factories in Tennessee and in Ohio.
And it was sent there to get away from the unions, to bust the unions.
But I'll tell you, they're efficient, and if they can do it more efficiently, then they should be doing it more efficiently. We can't go to less efficient ways and say we're willing to cut back on efficiency just so we can make more jobs.
But
the goal is to do as much as you can per job, not as little as you can.
Then we go back to what is the need for socialism, and there we are. We've done the circle because the basic needs of the human experience is what we really need to be discussing. Because if we talk about the right of the capitalist has only one thing on their mind: how can I make more money? And the need of the people and the need of society, what are we really contributing towards the future of our children?
Okay, I want to jump on what Rick said here about efficiency here, though. And if we have factories where we have workers instead of robots that cost a lot more to make the vehicles, you're going to have factories in places like Mexico and Japan and Germany that do use the robots. They're going to be able to make, number one, better cars, and they're going to be able to sell them at a lower price because we take all our money and we throw it into the wages of the workers. Can you address that issue?
Well, actually, I think we should be looking at the whole idea of everybody owning a car. There are other ways of getting around. And, you know, our resources that go into making those cars and fueling those cars are limited. And so we should be looking at something in the future. Where are we going to be in 50 years from now or 100 years from now? Because it's our grandchildren's future and our great-grandchildren, for my case. And what are we doing to give them a leg up? Are we really thinking that way?
So the solution to being inefficient to manufacturing cars is just not to buy cars.
No, it could be.
But if you talk to the people, executive people in Intel, Amazon, Yahoo, all the big high tech companies right now, and ask them what they project in another 30 years, they will say anywhere from 20 to 50% fewer jobs than we have now because of app technology. Now, how are we going to deal with that? I mean, how did only way I can see is to go back to Richard Milhouse Nixon's idea of a guaranteed income.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to do it because we're headed towards utopia in the fact of having all of the work done for us, but we don't have enough. We're too tribalistic to figure out how to divide it without being at each other's throats.
Well, we have another issue too that hasn't even come up, and this is the waste.
The waste. Yeah.
And so we're buying things cheaper. They don't last long. They're ending up in our landfills. And so where is really our basis? What is of value? What do we really consider of value? And so we can't keep living the way we're living. We have to really change the way we think. And capitalists have to, too. By the way, I've started several businesses. Just to let
you know. You're one of those evil capitalists.
No, I wouldn't say that. Actually, I remember World Bank, I had to go and talk to Mrs. Chalmers, and she was a real character, but because I started my own bank. And, you know, but I did it. You know why I did that? Because I went to a bank to get a loan for a business. No, open a checking account. And I had to have my husband's signature. And I thought, to hell with that.
Well, that seems to be more about sexism than capitalism.
But capitalism was, always has been, a male-dominant idea.
Okay, we're in another direction now.
this was Bank of America. So because of that, I decided it was time, and it was a woman's bank, and it was the second one in California, missed by 2 weeks.
That's sexism. Women's bank. Did you let men put money in?
Actually, yes, of course. Good. We also had a man who tried to kill his wife by driving into the bank because she was sitting at the desk and he was tired that she had a job and he didn't. So that was kind of the other thing that happened.
Female envy here going on.
Well, you know, no, it's really, and that's so strange. Why are we still at that point, you know? But what I'm trying to say is that capitalists have a responsibility. And that is, what am I contributing back to the society? And it may not just be by giving out awards and donations to different groups. It may be in building an infrastructure that can sustain itself.
Or make the system such that there can be more social justice. I want to talk a little bit more about Norway and the idea that they have these state-owned corporations that are on the world market with the oil, with the aluminum. How does that work? How would that work? Like in America, our governments have no businesses. I guess the only business we have is the insurance business with Medicare and Social Security. And that seems to have been working okay. So what about other industries that are government run? Is that doomed to fail just because government's inefficient and capitalism is not?
Well, that's the way we tend to categorize it.
So that's a belief then?
I think it's a prejudice.
Okay.
I think it's a belief. If government were efficient at running businesses, it would have started, and there would have been, you know, it would have started maybe at some city level, some state levels, maybe at some national levels, and it would have kept going. I think the fact that
it did go a national level in Norway, actually.
Yeah,
and it seemed
I don't know about Norway. I've only been to Oslo once and for a short period of time, but I need to go there sometime and learn a little bit more about what they're doing. But I can't think of any cases where government is really efficient. I mean, it's my feeling you can't make government efficient. You can make it, the only way you can do it is to make it smaller and force some efficiency.
I don't believe that for a minute. I mean, it's not the size, it's the holding it to account. I mean, a corporation and a big government agency are no different. Except the people in charge and the people that have the power to do it. I spent 40 years in the oil industry. I've worked for ARCO, BP, and ConocoPhillips. If you were to change the head on that and say this, all of a sudden this is a state-owned company, the same people would do the same jobs with the same enthusiasm and the same work ethic that they've always had.
If they had pride in their work.
Absolutely.
Well, and that's the other thing. We've denigrated our workforce. And that's really sad. And even the people that are working there will take up the chant. You know, it's like unions are bad. Well, what is a union? A union really is a place for people to go and support each other. When you're down and out in your luck, you're going to get something to get by until you get back up on your feet. But we always saw them as socialism. And my dad was called a communist. You know, and I'm just saying that we're back to the same point. What we really need to do is hold capitalists accountable, saying, okay, what are you contributing to our economy? Or are you just doing it to make money? Because we have a lot of those that just don't have to do hardly anything to make a lot of money.
To me, the mantra for small government means big business. Big business means small citizens.
So, Rick, you wore both hats. Mm-hmm. As an administrator in the municipality of Anchorage and as a businessman, are you saying that your business was run more effectively than your government?
Yeah, I think it is because it was smaller. We used our own money for it, and the managers in my business were held accountable for making a profit.
And you couldn't hold your government subordinates accountable when you were mayor?
For making a profit, no. But in terms of accomplishment, we really did work. And I think we probably did better than most. I think we left the city better than we found it.
So efficiency can occur in government
I think the correct leadership. Accomplishments can occur given the correct leadership, I think. And I think a smaller government, a city government, is more efficient than the state government. A state government is generally more efficient than the federal government because of the size. You know, when you it's a little bit like being a U.S. senator versus being mayor. When you're mayor, people understand the issues and you're accountable because they're right there. You're talking to them all the time. When you're a U.S. senator, you're separated from them and you're not accountable. And that's a good metaphor for federal government versus local government.
Which the distinction there also is a legislative is way different from an executive. Executive mm-hmm. is responsible for an organization that is to provide services, and the legislative is just to provide votes. And therefore, their organizations don't really have the same job description.
They don't. And the as mayor, you get credit for the success and you get blamed for the failure. The assembly, the 11-member assembly, is sort of a unknown body. It's just, they know the individual people, but they just blame the assembly. They don't know if they're blaming a single person, or they just give credit to the assembly. They don't know if they're giving credit to a single person. So there's accountability is a big deal, and government doesn't always have that.
I'm trying to think of the scientist, I think maybe his name is Suzuki, who characterizes the whole field of economics as a disease.
Well, what did he mean by that? Come on, Charles, you just can't throw that out and leave it alone. What did he mean by disease?
I mean that we're too deep into it to see it for what it is. I mean, we have a system as a means to an end. And the system becomes the mean. I mean, the end in itself, and we forget why we have an economic system in the first place.
It's often called the dismal science. Parson Malthus and David Ricardo. Dismal science.
But what economics. Do we expect of our government? You know, that'd be an interesting topic just to have on its own. Because are we expecting what they're doing? Are we putting the, you're talking about accountability. To me, accountability is listening to the people and acting on what their wishes are.
Well, a lot of times they wish that they just have a lot more money than their neighbor. That's a wish.
Perhaps it's also to secure a fishing stream that will always be sustainable and not give up your to someone that wants to come in and exploit it.
That's looking long term. Yeah. But do we really expect our government to treat us to long-term solutions like sustainability, as you mentioned, or just the short-term, I want my taxes reduced right now so I have more money in my pocket?
Well, actually, I think that basically when you really sit down and talk to people, they're going to say, what's best for my kids or my grandkids? And the getting by now is really talking about, I need a living wage.
You made the point earlier, Rick, about that in the 60s and 70s, long in there, we were headed towards democracy. Have you noticed that right now we're going the other way?
I think the country is more divided right now than it has been in my lifetime. And I'm 74 years old now, and I've got to say the country's been wonderful for me. You know, it's been the state has been wonderful for me. So I hear all the complaining and say that just doesn't pertain to me. Now, maybe I've worked harder, maybe I've worked smarter, maybe I've just were blessed with a better attitude from my parents. But I think this has been a great place to live for 70 years.
Me too. And I'm 74 also.
Are you? Okay. All right. We're there.
I'm the kid here. 73. You got a bunch of old.
In this discussion. But overall, and you know, things have changed not only because of the Trump-Clinton campaign and because of Donald Trump now, but the amount of media, the amount of coverage we have. There was a wonderful article in I forget where I saw it. I think it was maybe USA Today comparing 1981 to 2011. It was a 30-year comparison, so it was 6 years ago, and it was mostly prices of stuff and how it's gone up since 1980. But an interesting thing was on crime. In 1981. You had 17 chances in 10,000 of being a victim of an assault in any given year. In 2011, you had 6 chances out of 10,000 in being the victim of an assault. And so crime has generally gone down since 1981, but you see so much of it because there's so many more news, so many more media available that you see it from. And so you hear all about it. You know, the poor little gal who got kidnapped in Utah years ago, we heard about her for 3 or 4 years, and finally she was found, you know, in Salt Lake. But it was, there's and Joan Renee Bennett or from Boulder. You know, we hear so much about it. We think there's crime all over, but I was surprised, and then I kind of looked it up and realized that since from 1981 to 2011, this was 7 years ago, 6 years ago, I looked it up, and in fact, crime is down dramatically from 1980, and people don't realize
that. What about Anchorage?
Anchorage as well, I know it went down, we dropped it 43% from 1944 to 2000 when I was mayor, and now it's gone up again, so it went way down.
What do you think fuels that?
There is a theory from the guy that wrote Freakonomics that one of the reasons that it occurred, and he looked at the correlation of Roe v. Wade, is that a lot of people that end up committing crimes came from unwanted pregnancies, and they weren't able to stop those unwanted pregnancies, and therefore these people became – or these fetuses became people – and subsequently became criminals, and that was the reason the crime was so high prior to the period that you mentioned earlier. And then when they were allowed to terminate pregnancies or increase the birth control, that resulted in a lot of people growing up in homes where it wasn't So that's one theory. That's from
Freakonomics. Right now the opioid crisis is really driving crime I mean, burglary and robbery or whatever, in order to buy the pill.
That's what it seems like to me, too. And I know when I was mayor, the troopers would often tell me if we didn't have alcohol in the villages, we wouldn't have crime. But it may be different now. It may be drugs, and because that seems to be what's fueling a lot of the crime.
It's not in the villages.
It's in the cities now.
I want to get to another question. How does education fare in a purely capitalist economy? Can we talk a little bit about education and the socialist and versus capitalism?
Well, education is important, no doubt about it. But education is not the all-term solution in this. When apps are taking over jobs, because I tell you, in the future, people are going to be more and more subordinate to an app. You're going to have expertise at your fingertips. Expertise is not going to be the problem. The problem is the equity.
Is it important, though, that we have well-rounded, educated citizens?
That's a good point in itself. A liberal education is necessary just to be a human being and not a human doing.
That's a good point. I agree with you.
How does education fare in a purely capitalist economy?
I think that that's a good example of something we need, a mixed economy, because we can look at our grade 1 through our kindergarten through K through 12, and that's generally a socialistic system where the government pays for it, and so it's generally socialism. Our university system is less socialistic. It's a little more capitalistic, not fully, because it has state universities as well as a lot of private universities, but it's more capitalistic than that. Our university system is generally considered one of the best in the world. I mean, people are coming from all over. Asians are flooding the West Coast. Well, and the East Coast, too, and American universities. So they seem to be doing better. You hear criticism of how our K through 12 is doing, and I'm not an expert on that, so I don't know. But it's an example of a need for a socialist system, a system where government provides that particular service, like roads and education is another one.
It'd be nice if college was less expensive. I mean, these kids coming out with these huge debts to jobs that are never going to give them enough income to pay it back.
The huge debts is because of all of the how easy we made it for students to borrow money, and they're saying, you know, I can get $6,000 a year, $8,000 a year, and they're walking away with a lot of money.
Well, that's not it totally. It's also the cost of going to school, just how much it's increased.
Well, the student loans have increased that. They've caused lots and lots more people to go to college, which is a good thing.
Good.
The colleges are building facilities.
It's two-sided. It's the loans that are really loan sharks, and it's the cost of the education, the cost of the books.
Now, the loan sharks, can you give me some examples?
The federal government.
The federal government. Yeah, maybe that's right.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, you go to one of these private colleges that says they're going to give you a great education. Mm-hmm. And look at
They're still funded by the federal government loans.
Some of them are.
Yeah. All right, I want to talk a little bit about, we have a couple minutes left, about the two major utilities in the Valley, the MTA and the MEA. Mm-hmm. They are co-ops, which means that the customers are the members, owners of the institutions. Do those associations follow more of a socialist or capitalist model?
Well, they're non-profit.
Okay.
I think they might be paying their CEOs too much, but outside of that, you know, it was really kind of fun when those were started. I remember when there was a telephone company before MTA, and it was a fellow here that started it in his living room. And he ran a line from Palmer to Wasilla, and the big event was for the two mayors to talk on the phone, and we all were excited. Well, of course, that fall, the moose went through the lines that were only strung from tree to tree, and it'd be a few years later. What was really nice about that was the fact that we all could communicate via telephone. That changed our way of our social.
We have a few minutes left. Rick, you wanted anything to say now?
You know, on that area, I've lived in the Valley for about 10 years, and a second home, actually, in the Valley for 10 years. So I always lived in Anchorage. But I think it's more an example of socialism than it is entrepreneurial. It's a bit of a compromise. But I think conclusion today that we've reached, and this has been very stimulating for me, I've really enjoyed this, is that I think that we need a balance between capitalism and socialism. Capitalism produces, socialism sort of distributes.
On that note, I want to thank you all for coming. And we really enjoyed this very stimulating conversation. And we will have you all back soon in a future episode. Thanks. Goodbye. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.